And now for our speaker will be Don P from the Three Legacies of Naples.
Hi everybody, my name is Don Popejoy. I'm an alcoholic. By God's grace and sponsorship and the 12 steps, I've been sober since February the 21st, 1980. And I'm grateful for my sobriety, and I want to thank you for inviting me to come back here and speak. I was here maybe 6 years ago, if my memory's right, and that's got to be plus or minus at my age. And then I was supposed to be here about this time last year. We live on Marco Island, Florida, and we left about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and thought 5 hours should allow ample time to get here for the meeting. And by 5 o'clock, we got to Tampa yet. So the traffic was pretty bad. So today we, in appreciation for you having faith in me to try to get here one more time. I told Susan we're gonna leave early. As soon as the president was sworn in, we got in the car and drove up here, and we didn't even have to slow down all the way up. So it was an easy trip. We had a nice dinner at the Bonefish Grill. I'm very glad to be here. My home group, as Natalie said, is the Three Legacies group. We meet in Naples on Monday night. We're an open speaker meeting, something like this. I want to say something to the little group of you that came up and took a silver chip. I'm going to make you a promise. If you'll join us and come here and get a sponsor and buy a big book and go through the steps with that sponsor and just do what we do, I promise you, you won't ever have to take a silver chip again. When I was about 2 or 3 years sober, I went to a state conference and Clancy I from California was the speaker. And he talked about something that he talked about quite a bit in those days, and that were pockets of enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked about how in a lot of places in AA, in 1982 or three, there were meetings that really had the negative answer to that question in our big book: are we confined to a life that's stupid, boring, and glum? Because it's that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. People will tell you guys that they've never been to a bad AA meeting, and they're not really telling you the truth. I've been to AA meetings, some of them that stunk so bad you could smell them all the way across town. Because we're not consigned to a life that's stupid and boring and glum. I was lucky, like you are lucky tonight, that I was 12-stepped into a group of Alcoholics Anonymous in a little out-of-the-way farm town in the southwest corner of Kansas by the name of Ulysses that had one AA group. And they were a pocket of enthusiasm. They took all kinds of joy and happiness and glee into their AA meetings and into their AA life. And like you, I see you people all up and down the state of Florida at various AA things. And that's what we did. We got in the car and went. And we went as a fellowship, and we had fellowship after the meeting. And if I lived anywhere near here, you would be my home group, I promise you that. So I'm very grateful to be here, what I used to be like. Someone came up to me tonight that either heard me speak or heard my tape from some years ago, and was talking about one of the, I don't know about you, I'm the kind of a drunk that when I drink, I get in a lot of trouble. And I used to try to talk about what I used to be like by telling you the trouble I got into with some of my escapades while I was drinking. And I had a lot of them. I had my first significant drink. I might have had a sip of whiskey of some kind when I was 17 years old and my folks left town. And I talked my dad into letting me borrow his Ford Coupe, 54 Ford Coupe. We went to the drive-in theater, and one of the guys that I picked up had a half a pint of tequila in his car. He passed it around, and I wasn't ever going to drink. I promised myself I wouldn't ever drink because my home was afflicted with the illness of alcoholism. I knew all the broken promises and the broken dreams, the kind of dysfunction that just comes with an alcoholic home, and I said I won't ever do that. But when they handed me that bottle, without one thought, I picked it up and took the biggest swig I could, and I coughed and sputtered, and I thought that stuff is terrible, and I handed it to the guy in the back seat. And then I had one of these thoughts that have plagued me all my life. They're thoughts that overcome all other thoughts. I didn't know the definition for that till I heard a beautiful black man from Little Rock, Arkansas, when I was 11 months sober, tell me that's called an obsession, and I get them. And I developed an obsession right then, and the obsession was, I hope to Christ there's some of that stuff left when it gets back to me. Silkworth had it right. He wrote some words the year I was born, 1938. Book was published in 39, but he wrote these words in 38. He said, the alcoholic at some time loses the ability to differentiate the truth from the false. The truth from the false. And you see, when I took that drink of whiskey, it let the false become the truth to me. I mean, there wasn't, my whole personality changed, and it was that way from then on. There were a lot of things that I tried. You know, I've been, essentially what I used to be like was plagued with a couple of basic fears, and sometimes today I still am. They're what we can call the self-centered fears. Number one, I'm not gonna get something that I desperately have to have, and I'm afraid I won't do that. And number two, I'm afraid that something I already have, I'm gonna lose. And those two fears just fueled all kinds of defects of character in this guy and caused me lots of trouble in my drinking history. There were times when I thought other things were what I had to have, long before sobriety. One day, I guess it was, must have been in the early to mid 70s, or no, early 70s, I think. I was shaving, and I happened to look in the mirror, and things had not been going well for me in my drinking episodes. And I looked in the mirror and I thought, my God, that's what's wrong. See, I've been this bald-headed since I was 26 years old. And I said, that's what's missing in my life, hair. So I made some inquiries and I found there was a doctor in Wichita that was 240 miles away that specialized in making bald guys have hair. So I called his office and made an appointment, and the day came, I got in my little Cessna airplane and flew to Wichita. I parked in front of a liquor store, walked across the street. The doctor's office was upstairs, and he explained to me that for $5,000, he could cut 50 plugs of hair out of the back of my neck and then cut 50 plugs of hair out of the top of my head in rows, and then transplant those plugs of hair from the back of my neck into the little holes in the top of my head. And if we got lucky, grow me 5 or 10 cornrows of hair. And he said, what do you think? And I said, not much. I said, $5,000 is a lot of money. It sounds like it hurt like hell. I'm not into pain. And I said, the real clincher, Dr. Brown, is that you're more ball-headed than I am. If it works so good, why don't you do it to yourself? And he said, I guess it doesn't bother me to be ball-headed. And I said, I guess it doesn't bother me that much either. So He wanted 50 bucks for the consultation. I paid him that one. I walked across the street into the liquor store and bought a fifth of J&B. There were some places I liked in Wichita, down on the south side of Seneca Avenue, if you've ever been there. That's where the dives are. And I opened the door of my car, tossed a 50, and I was getting ready to drive down there. And the easier, softer way just jumped up and bit me in the butt. I've always been susceptible to easier, softer ways. I was parked not only in front of a liquor store, but in the other half of that building was a barbershop. It was a barbershop that had about 10 models of men's heads made out of styrofoam sitting in the window. And on each one of those styrofoam heads was a full head of hair. And I went in and asked the guy about that, and he said, "We specialize in men's hair pieces." And an hour or so later, and $350 later, which is a lot less than $5,000, I walked out with a full head of hair looking like one of my heroes, a country and western singer named Glenn Campbell. I had a pompadour that went from here to here. Full head of hair. There is a challenge when you're bald-headed and you want to wear a hairpiece. You got to make the hairpiece stick to the bald head. The answer then, it could be different now, was they sold me a roll of double-sided adhesive tape. And they have you cut it in little strips. And you peel one side off the tape and stick it on the inside of the hairpiece. So you little strips all the way around. Then you peel the other side off. Now you got a sticky side down and a sticky side up, and you stick it on your head, plaster it with hairspray, and you're ready to go do the boogaloo. That's what I did. I headed to that joint down on South Seneca Street. They had a cowboy band playing, a little three-piece cowboy band playing in the back of the room, very small dance floor. And I started drinking that scotch, and when, as I said, booze makes the false become the truth. I'm not a very good dancer, except when I'm drinking. And then I'm the best dancer in the state of Kansas. And I'm somewhat shy and reserved. We go to a party today and she'll say, "Aren't you gonna go around and talk to anybody? But put a couple of three belts of that J&B in my belly and I'll talk your arm off." Because the false becomes the truth. And I was dancing and talking and I thought doing pretty good. And then it happened. When I drink enough booze, it not only changes my perception of reality, but it starts coming out the top of my head in the form of perspiration. Makes my head sweat. And adhesive tape abhors perspiration. And I was sweating and the tape started getting loose and turning loose. Pretty soon the dadgum wig turned around sideways on the top. And it does not impress anyone to have the part on your hair running from ear to ear. They're no longer interested. I wore that hairpiece for 3 or 4 years, I can't remember. I was in the asphalt paving business, and we did quite a bit of work in Colorado in those days, and I had bid a job in Alamosa, Colorado, to rebuild a runway. And I was staying in a Holiday Inn, and one night, I spent a lot of time in the bar of that Holiday Inn, and one night I just made it back to my room, and sometimes it wouldn't all come loose. Sometimes just one side would come loose. And then it'd flop over and you'd kind of have a half scalp look that didn't impress anybody. And that had happened that night. I got back to my room and I was going to take it off. And all of a sudden I had to make my evening oblations before the throne of American standard. And some of you have been there, the porcelain throne. And I got down on my knees and it all came up. And that last piece of tape gave loose. And it was an ugly mess. It really, I might have been the town drunk, but I was not the village idiot. I didn't fish it out. I just hit the silver handle and waved goodbye to the whole mess. I went to work the next day and he said, "What the hell happened to your hair?" And I said, "Oh, I decided to become the real me." And the real me found it necessary on a very regular basis to alter his perception of reality, with the only thing that ever could work for a while to do that, and that was booze. Before I get to that point, which was in February of 1980, the chap that talked to me about the troubles I used to get into, one time I got drunk and wrecked an airplane. A Caterpillar tractor salesman had called on me at noon, and we decided to go have a few drinks and have lunch. Well, we didn't ever have lunch. We had quite a few drinks. And we decided we wanted to travel. I don't know whether that ever happened to you when you were drinking, but sometimes I felt I needed to travel when I was drinking. And we thought we were too drunk, we'd probably get arrested for a DUI, so we decided to fly. And it didn't turn out well. I tried to do an aileron roll, and it was too close to the ground. I pancaked the airplane, and we lived, and we were cut up, bloodied up. The doctor that patched us up said, Susan had taken the kids and gone to Wichita to see her sister, and said, "You better call your wife." So I called Susan, and she was not happy. And she hired some guy to fly her home in the middle of the night. And the next day, Susan and my mother had a group conscience meeting. They used to have those, and they didn't invite me. I like the AA meetings better, the group conscience meetings. Actually, I hate AA group conscience meetings, but well, that'll... I don't want to scare these four off. So they decided in their group conscious meeting that they were going to take me to Denver and see a shrink. And they did, and the shrink looked at me, and I looked at the shrink, and he said, "Do you always do things like this when you drink?" And I said, "Well, sometimes they aren't this bad." But he said, "Then why do you drink like that?" And I said, "Beats the hell out of me. You're the doctor. Why don't you tell me?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, I don't know either." So he gave me some tranquilizers or something and sent me on the way. I took them for a while, and things got too slow, so I threw them away and bought a tip. But the point I'm trying to make is, and this is where I was in February of 1980, the question he asked was a good one. Why did I drink like that? Why was the obsession and compulsion to drink so powerful in me? And I think it was that's the only way I could find the answer to those basic fears of my life, those self-centered fears. And I didn't drink every day by that time. I could make it a few days, and then the reality was more than I could bear, and I could have a few drinks, and for a little bit. Well, like Silkworth said, what happens at once when we have a few drinks? And we don't have to drink a gallon of whiskey to get that sense of relief. And that was my whole life. I don't believe that alcoholism is a moral affliction. But during the course of active alcoholism in my life, I violated all the moral principles that I'd been taught as a child. I crossed all those moral boundaries. I became a liar and a cheat and a thief. Became an absentee husband to Susan. I brought the fatal affliction to any marriage, into our marriage, infidelity. I was a part-time husband to the kids. I would sneak away during the week and stay drunk for two or three days, and then try to go home and shake it out and give them a lot of verbal and mental abuse out of my guilt, shame, and remorse. And that's what life was like for this alcoholic in late February of 1980. We were still married, but kind of just in name only. I mean, that is, we lived in the same house. The kids, I think, were mostly afraid of me. I have a very few friends left. I can remember one time, not too long before the end of my drinking, Susan and I were in the kitchen, and she said, "Well, do you think you could quit drinking?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I think I could quit drinking, but what would I do? All my friends would leave. I mean, I didn't have three or four of them left by then anyway." Speak to me. But one morning I had a little business going in Denver. It afforded me a place to go drink. And I was in my office getting ready to walk out the door, and the phone rang, and it was Susan. And she said, "Joyce, who's the lady that worked for, and I need to go to Denver. Can we ride out to Denver with you?" And I said, "Yeah, meet me at the airport." I should have been able to come up with 10 reasons in a couple of seconds why she couldn't go, because I was living a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of life in Denver, and obviously I didn't want Susan there. And then you might wonder why I didn't want Joyce to go. She had been fun to drink with for a long time, Joyce. But on New Year's Eve of that year, she had in a blackout tried to kill herself, and they had pumped her stomach, and she'd started going to this ridiculous outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I seriously didn't want her to go. But they jumped in the plane with me, and we flew to Denver. I kept a room rented at the Holiday Inn on South Colorado Boulevard, and we checked into the hotel, and they must have gone to do whatever they came to do. I went to the bar, and that's the last thing I remember about February 20 of 1980. I came to the next morning. I knew I was in trouble because Susan was in the room. She must have ordered some coffee, because some coffee came, and the person that brought it, you know, he poured the coffee for me, and I had both hands around it, but I was shaking so bad I was pouring most of it down the front of my shirt. And I guess Susan had called Joyce, because she came leaping and bounding into the room with her little bright, clear AA eyes. And she said, "Good morning, Donald, how are you?" And I said, "Joyce, I'm not worth a damn." And that, my friends, was your speaker's wimpy moment of truth. That's when I ran out of lies. And I said, "Joyce, would you tell me something about AA?" And about that time it started snowing, so we knew we couldn't fly home. And she spent that day and most of the evening telling me about her experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Joyce was 7 weeks sober. Don't think, those of you that are relatively new, that you have to be sober like this old man for a long period of time to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to another alcoholic. If that were the case, I wouldn't be here tonight. She told me about what her life was like and the changes she was making in her life. She talked to me about the steps. She'd been through step 7 and was working on her and made the first half of the 8th step as she was getting ready to do her amends. And I know the weather, Susan said she never got so tired of hearing people talk about drinking and not drinking. The weather was nice the next morning. We flew home. Susan still was hardly speaking to me. So that night I came home early from work, and I was helping with the dishes in the kitchen, which is a sure tip off that I'm not going to sleep in the big bed unless I can take it. And the doorbell rang, and I opened the door, and there was Joyce. It was cold, February night in Kansas, snow on the ground. And I said, "Joyce, come in. It's cold out there. You'll freeze." She said, "No, you come. You promised me you'd go to an AA meeting with me." And I had some dim recollection of that. But I said, "Well, Joyce, I didn't mean tonight, and it's too cold." And she was a big Kansas farm girl and had a parka on, and she grabbed me right by the collar of the shirt and dragged me out the door, opened the door of the car, threw me into the car, and she said, "Get your miserable ass in the car, we're going to AA." And the really surprising thing about that is that I've been coming back ever since. I went to the meeting of this little group that I told you about when I started tonight. Town of 3,000 people, they had 5 meetings a week. They just harangued you until you got somebody to be your sponsor. And what they said to me was, "Come do what we do, and then you'll have what we have, and you won't have to drink anymore." And they promised me that. So I asked a guy to be my sponsor, and he started picking me up and taking me to other town, taking me to meetings there and on those other two nights to other towns for meetings. And he gave me assignments in the big book, and he took me through the steps. I got ready. He told me it was time to write my fourth step. I told him I was far too busy. He'd have to wait until the next construction season and the end of this construction season. And he showed up in my office with a big pad of yellow paper and three number two pencils. And he said, write until you either run out of paper or pencil, Ed, and be in my house Thursday night. So I didn't do what the big book said. I wrote the immoral litany of my life. I talked about all the things that I had done. And I showed up at his house, and I handed him the papers. And he handed them back, and he said, this is your inventory. You wrote it. You read it. I'll listen. And God is here. And so halfway through that inventory, talking about all my moral afflictions, he said, stop for a minute, Don. And I looked up, and tears were running down his face, and I thought, he's going to ask me to leave. I did. But what he said was, my God, do you realize you're telling me the story of my life? He was the best man I thought I'd ever met. And if he could have ever done something like that and got to where he is now, I thought there might be hope for me. He'd also told me not to read ahead, but nobody ever listens to their sponsor. So we did step five. We went through step six and seven in the big book just as quick as it takes to read step six and seven in the big book. I had no idea what they were about. Actually, I was probably sober about 10 years before I began to get a pretty good understanding, the beginning of a good understanding about what sticks or seven are about. But we could talk for a whole another hour and a half about that. And he said, now take out a clean sheet of paper. And I said, no, Lou, I can't do that. And he said, we're going to make the list. And I said, I know, I read ahead. He said, I told you not to read ahead. I said, I did read ahead. And I said, I can't clean it up. There's too much of it, Louie. I can't ever get it cleaned up. And he said, we're just going to make the GD list. Write these names down. I'm getting them from your inventory. And he grabbed my paper, and he went through, and I wrote the names down. And he said, now go home to, you know, gave me the directions. Take the book down from the shelf. See if we're making, if we've skipped anything, if we're trying to make mortar out of sand. And I didn't do any of that. I went home and wrote a letter of resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. Louis' sponsor was an ex-professional rodeo cowboy. When Louis moved away, this guy named Jerry became my sponsor. But he used to talk about, he'd say, is that we'd be talking about the amend steps. And he'd say, if you're a drunken horse thief, and you decide you need to do something about your drinking, you're probably going to have to also quit stealing horses. And the reason I didn't want to make that list is I wasn't sure I wanted to quit stealing all the horses in my life. But he said, I hadn't given it to him. We had agreed to go to an AA conference down in the Peladura Canyon of Texas. And after the speaker that night, there's a guy in my home group whose name was Bernie, and he came up to me and made an amends to me over something I didn't know he owed me amends for. And I said, Bernie, I don't want your money. And he said, you don't understand. Ever since you walked in the doors of that group, I've been afraid I'm going to start drinking. I've got so much guilt over this. It wasn't something that I felt mounted to a hill of beans. But he had to make amends to me so he could stay sober. And the light went on in my head, and I went back to Louis's room, and I said, I guess I'm ready to do the deal. And I said, you're never going to believe what Bernie just did. And he said, I got an idea. He was Bernie's sponsor. So we started through the house cleaning of step nine with Susan and the kids, my mother, the people in work that I had lied and cheated and stolen from. I'd been involved in some illegal business activities called bid rigging. And I've written all that out in my inventory. I said, do you understand what I'm talking about? He said, yeah. You didn't have to write all that about it. I said, why? He said, one word covers it all. I said, well, what's that one word? He said, stealing, and you got to quit. Because what he had told me is that I had to change. I had to quit doing what I've been doing and start doing what AA was telling me to do. It sounds like a big hill, but you do it a little bit at a time. And so you don't get winded before you get to the top. And little by little and bit by bit, as I made my amends, the relationships in my life began like phoenix to rise from the ashes. And things got better. It took time, and it also took me not committing any more infidelity, but it took time for Susan to come to the point that she could forgive me for that. And our marriage began to grow and blossom, and she's been a member of Al-Anon since I was 3 weeks sober. And her being a member of Al-Anon didn't keep me sober, but it greatly enhances my sobriety, and I am so grateful to the Al-Anon family groups for what's happened in our life in recovery. We've had our tragedies also. We had two kids, a son, Stephen, and a daughter, Linda. We knew from the time our son was in junior high school that he had a problem with drugs, and he had a problem with drugs, and we got him help, and he had some trouble in college and then got back into college and did pretty well. And he ended up graduating from medical school at the University of Colorado in the early part of 1993. But we got he was doing his residency at Duke University. We got a call from his wife, Kate. They had a little baby, Sam. She said, you need to come to Raleigh. Stephen's in real bad shape. He had he'd worked two things back to back, and then he'd gone to his on-call room and he had cooked up a little mixture of synthetic opiates and injected himself in the ankle. He had gone immediately into unconsciousness, and when they found him the next morning that he didn't show up for grand rounds, he was still breathing, but he was brain dead. And we flew down there, and Kate made the decision, and we supported it, that they'd turn off the machines. And we held him in our arms when the lines went flat on all the monitors. And that's what alcoholism is. It's not getting drunk and losing your wig. It's a killer. It kills our relationships, it kills our kids, and it'll kill us. Unless we're blessed and so fortunate, so incredibly fortunate to find this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And not all of us that find it are able to find lasting recovery. And I wanted to know why after he died. And I drove myself crazy wanting to know why. Until I got asked to speak at a men's retreat down near Norman, Oklahoma. And there was a giant of a man there, both spiritually and physically, named Ed Mueller. And I shared this with Ed, and he said, Don, the problem is you're trying to play God. You're trying to know an answer that is only known in the mind of God. And he said, until you surrender that and give it to God, you're going to be plagued with this kind of terrible, horrible grief. And he said, are you ready? And I said, yeah. And we got down on our knees beside of his bed, and I held my hands up, and I gave that to God, and he's had it ever since. And I can come to groups like this and look at these young men and not say, why can they make it and not my son? Or for that matter, why can they make it? Why can I make it and not my son? And I don't have to do that anymore. I can rejoice in their sobriety. So AA has given me, really, in so many ways, back what the illness of alcoholism took from me. because I get to share in the lives of many young men today and women. I was telling our meeting chairman tonight, you know, if she has a normal lifespan and if she doesn't ever drink again, she could be sober 77 years when she dies. Think about that. But we've had so many gifts and so many blessings. I ended up having to go to prison for 2 months over that bid reading stuff. And I had a good AA buddy named Kenneth. It's important to have an AA buddy because you need to talk to your AA buddy to see if it's bad enough to bother your sponsor about in the first place. And it was a federal charge, and in the federal system, I don't know, this was 35 years ago. In the federal system, they sent us home for a pre-sentence investigation, and everybody that knew me in AA wrote the judge a letter and said they knew I hadn't rigged any bids since I did my fifth step. But Susan and I did a kind of silly thing. We went home and started watching late night movies on TV about life in hard time prisons. And she became afraid they were going to hurt me physically, like kill me or something, which is the least of my concerns. I thought something else was going to happen. And I went to Kenneth to share with him my deep fear. I did, and he just roared with laughter like you just did. And I said, God damn it, I just shared my guts with you, and you're laughing at me. And he said, Don Popejoy, your ego knows no bounds. I said, I didn't get it. It went right by me. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, look at yourself. He said, you're middle-aged, pot-bellied, and bald-headed. Baby, you ain't got what they want. And he was right. So it's been I've been rocketed into a fourth dimension. That'll happen to you guys too. You come do what we do, and you'll have what we have, and we won't live in the kind of world that we lived in before, none of us. It's a new dimension. And it's a dimension that knows God. And that's how I want to wrap this thing up tonight. I want to tell you, when I first, you know, our 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I'll tell you when I don't know exactly when that happened. I know the first time I was aware of it. In that little group in that little town that had one hospital and two doctors, there wasn't any treatment center within 150 miles. So when a doctor would put somebody in a hospital for acute alcoholism and they would detox them, that's what they were doing, try to keep them from going into seizures. Sometimes they'd have DTs. Anyway, we had a deal. The AA group had a deal with those two doctors in the hospital. If a patient was willing, we'd go up from 10 at night till 6 in the morning, two at a time, and try to help the nurses. That wasn't true. We went up from 10 at night till 6 in the morning to pitch the guy on the bed. That was our big 12-step deal. And one night, about 7 o'clock, Bernie, the guy that made amends to me, called me and he said, Don, your name's on the list about going up to the hospital. I need you to go up from 4 to 6. I said, Bernie, I've got to drive all the way down Oklahoma Panhandle. We're doing an asphalt paving job down. I've got to be down there at 7 in the morning. It takes me an hour to get down there. He said, you can make it just on time. So he said, this is AA. We don't say no to an AA request. And I said, well, don't make a federal case out of it. I'll go. So I met this guy down in the hospital that night. And we went into Raymond's room, and Raymond was a pitiful case of humanity. He was strapped to 3 or 4 IVs. He was incoherent, thank you. And he He couldn't talk to us. We couldn't pitch him. But we'd all been there, and the only thing we could do, he was getting all these fluids, and he couldn't use a bedpan, so he refused to use a bedpan. So we'd have to get him up and off the bed and walk him into the bathroom, dragging these trolleys along with us. And he could relieve himself, and he had terrible aim, and the floor was wet, my shoes were wet, and I thought, if I get out of this, I won't ever do anything this dumb again. And 6 o'clock came, and the nurses came in and said, you guys can go. But the only other thing we did, we helped him chase imaginary green dogs off his bed. We only did two things for Raymond. And I stood out in the parking lot, and I lit a cigarette, and I opened my car door, and tears started pouring down my face. And I thought, this is so stupid. I've just spent 2 hours with the dregs of humanity. That guy has nothing that I want. And this is the best I've ever felt in my life. And then the thought came. I said, I can't remember when I wanted to take a drink. And I knew then, as much as I've known every day since then, that the God of my understanding, the creator of the universe and me, came into my life because through AA, through you asking me and helping me to do something outside of myself without any expectation of anything in return, that peeled away the layers of self over my soul and let Almighty God come in and fix what was broke with me. Sometimes people say, why do you want to drive 210 miles and talk to somebody? And I said, because I feel when I get done the same as I felt that morning with Raymond. I was aware of the presence of God in my life. That's what you do for me. Thank you for having me.